we're checking in on local efforts to prepare for climate change in Monroe County. That's in the southwest portion of our state in the Driftless area. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Over the past about a dozen years or so, Monroe County has experienced an increase in extreme rains. Severe flooding in 2018, it caused multiple dam failures. It was a wake-up call, and the county formed a climate change task force. How has climate change affected your community? Local leaders, how are you struggling to find ways to address severe weather events? Can you get buy-in on your plans? 800-642-1234. Bob McKeel is director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department. Bob, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be back and discuss the Monroe County Climate Change Task Force.
Well, take us back in time to the time when the task force formed. You know, dams break in 2018. This is a very severe situation. How did the county make that decision to tackle climate change?
Well, I would say it's an accumulation of storm damage over, I always go back to 2007. It seems like there's a continual pattern, at least in the southern portion of Monroe County on the Vernon County line. But this has been going on for a while. We've had at least 20-some events in the Driftless area, not all in Monroe County, that has affected us. If it doesn't hit a community with a large population, you probably don't hear about it. But there's still a lot of lives affected with these storm events. And so 2018 is the one that everybody saw nationally. A lot of communities affected, a lot of dams breached during that event. But really in 2019, we had the same trend three times again. Again, it didn't hit a large community, but there was some huge amount of damage to agriculture. And at that point, I knew we had to do something different. And working with the county administrator, county board chair, that's when we decided to form the Climate Change Task Force, assemble a team of experts, residents, landowners, unique groups, and come to the table and have this discussion.
Yeah, so it looks like you have 16 members on this task force. You meet once a month, is that right?
That's correct, once a month. And we also try to bring in expertise because climate change is, for the most part, there's more questions than answers. And so we're always trying to bring outside expertise in to educate us and steer us in directions of positive impact on the landscape.
And a lot of what you're doing is also gathering data, gathering information. Why is that data important for your long-term plan?
So the data collection that we're involved with is really about the rainfall intensity, collecting precipitation, trying to figure out what that intensity rate is, along with putting sensors in the streams. And these sensors monitor the depth on a 15-minute interval. And so we can kind of tie the precipitation intensity to what's happening to the streams. And we can determine what kind of reaction or how our conservation practices may be functioning or infrastructure is functioning to certain storm events. Along with the most important thing is we need to do a better job of warning the public to keep them out of harm's way.
Yeah, how do those hydrology numbers and those facts then inform how you talk with residents about this?
And so most of the residents, again, we've had a lot of events, so they know that this is an issue. And they're more than willing to participate and help us get to that point where we're getting more sensors on the landscape. We even have created a donation fund. We have quite a few residents that have contributed, businesses that have contributed dollars to these sensors, because it's all about information. You can't react without information and scientific information. So we're working on that end. We're also working with the National Weather Service. They're creating a southwestern hydraulic or hydrology monitoring page, so the public would have access to that beyond the warnings, so they can keep a pulse on the sensors that affect their watershed.
We're talking with Bob McKeel, director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department. He's a member of the county's Climate Change Task Force. You can join in. Have you seen climate change affect your community? What questions do you have about local solutions, local action? Join in at 800-642-1234. Bob, Governor Evers had included money in his budget proposal for exactly the kind of thing you're doing in Monroe County. It was stripped out by Republican lawmakers. So in not having that state support, how is Monroe County funding this work on climate change?
Unfortunately, it was struck out of the budget moving forward. I can vouch that it is easily a full-time position in a county to tackle this challenge. As far as Monroe County, how are we handling it? We are picking up the slack wherever we can get our professionals to step forward in Monroe County, and we have support of our county administrator and county board. So for instance, I have a land use planner, we have the zoning administrator, the forester. They're all coming forward, the GIS specialists contributing time to this effort, along with all the elected officials and other professionals coming to the table.
You're also talking with some homeowners who are in the floodway. Their homes are at risk. What is it like to talk with them about moving?
So we're fortunate enough to secure some grant funding through FEMA Hazard Mitigation Program, along with the DNR Municipal Flood Control Grant and Community Development Block Grant Program. So the focus or the target is these residents that are in the floodway, been subject to chronic flooding. Their house or basement will get flooded. For instance, in 2018, they get money to rebuild, get their home back up to what they remember, and it gets hit again the following year. So that's what we targeted, and really it's an easy sell when you can offer them dollars to buy them out so they can retain that value and go somewhere else, because it's when the thunder starts booming and the lightning and they know there's another storm event in the watershed, it gets pretty uneasy to go to sleep right next to a river or a stream that consistently hits your house. So we've got 8 or 9 homes that we're working with as far as demoing and removing from the floodplain and returning it to green space.
What is happening to your floodplains? Are they filling up with water?
So the floodplains, for the most part, over time, I would say before, you know, the last 10, 15 years, says humans have gotten comfortable occupying that area. So whether it's homes or infrastructure, agriculture, farming next to the stream. And what we're finding is nature is trying to reclaim that valley floor. It is flat for a reason. Water, it is to contain the water during these flood events. And so we need to recognize that and help people make better decisions in that corridor.
Bob McKeel is director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department, part of the county's Climate Change Task Force. We're discussing climate change, how one county, Monroe, in southwest Wisconsin is confronting it. How is your county dealing with this? Are your residents wondering how to handle repairing roads, bridges, relocating households out of floodplains? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment for more conversation on climate change here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're checking in on the work of Monroe County's Climate Change Task Force, the 16-member group. It meets once a month. They kicked off their climate readiness and rural economic opportunity assessment this month, an 8-month project to study the effects of climate change, make recommendations for what they call resiliency plans. Is your county studying the local effects of climate change? What have you learned? How has your community been affected by storms? Did a dam give way? What was that like? Join in 800-642-1234. Bob McKeel is the county's Land Conservation Department Director and on the Climate Change Task Force. He's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Brett now, joining us from Norwalk. Hi, Brett. Go ahead.
Good morning. I had a comment and a question. Basing some of my suppositions off of the Alan Savory Institute, he has about a 20-minute TED Talk that would be able to share what I'm thinking a lot better than I can. But I just wondered, is there any discussion of financial economic encouragement of rotational grazing and some of the benefits of sequestering carbon in the soil, especially in an area like the Driftless in southern Monroe County, where we can get huge amounts of rain per year, but safely manage that in a grassland situation with rotational grazing?
Brett, thank you. What are your insights there, Bob?
Yes, that's a good point. And as far as this project that we're involved with Wisconsin Green Fire, we've broken it out into four sub-teams, and one of those is the agricultural sub-team, and that is to focus on what are our mitigation options or opportunities. And so rotational grazing or managed grazing is one of those as we move forward, just as long as, you know, the other parts are implementing buffer strips or native grasses or tree plantings, type of cover crops you're using in your rotation. But yes, grazing is one of those key components, and that will be a point where we need to get dollars out there to cost share to help landowners make those changes. So yes, good point.
And quantifying carbon credits, how would this help, with the climate change?
So again, there's more questions in the climate change world as far as carbon stocks and mitigating or sequestering carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the one thing we need to learn in Wisconsin is what practices give us the most gain in agriculture as far as sequestering carbon. And we do have dollars or grant through the Department of Ag to actually put some demonstrations out there and learn from that and put numbers to it to quantify it. So by the end of next year, we're hopeful that we can share numbers and point the direction to what practices give us the most bang for our buck when it comes to climate change mitigation.
Well, let's look more closely at infrastructure. How are you working on upgrading roads, bridges, how infrastructure works in your county as you look at these severe rain events?
So our infrastructure, of course, is composed of municipalities from the towns. We have 24 townships. We have the county highway department and obviously the state highways. Our infrastructure in the southern part of the county is really taking a beating, specifically in the town level. The size of the structures, if they're perched, their condition is really getting hammered. And so we've had a discussion about how can we do an assessment or an inventory of all the crossings, which are culverts and bridges in the county, to rank them and put them in an order of climate resiliency or fish passage and condition, and get funding targeted to those worst case scenarios. So this year we actually have hired two interns that they'll be, their focus is to start that inventory assessment process in the southern part of the county and slowly work north, realizing we have over 1,700 crossings.
Wow.
In Monroe County that we have to evaluate.
Yeah, that's a lot. That'll be quite a bit of inventory for those interns, right, to tackle.
I haven't told them yet.
We're talking with Monroe County Land Conservation Department Director Bob McKeel. We're learning how the county is taking a proactive approach to climate change after severe flooding through the years. You can join in. Have you incurred flooding in recent years? Is that related to an infrastructure failure? How has the increased intensity of storms impacted your land, your home, your roads, your culverts? 800-642-1234. I'm wondering, Bob, Fort McCoy, the Army installation between Sparta and Tomah, is in Monroe County. How are you involving Fort McCoy in your planning?
Fort McCoy has always been a great partner for us at the county level, whether it's sharing ideas or information or labor, working on a stream project, so their natural resource department, along with plenty of information sharing between the county and the installation. But they are a partner sitting at the table in the Climate Change Task Force. So they're marching right with us. And they're also a part of the team with this Green Fire Project doing this assessment. So they're 60,000 acres of Monroe County's 580,000, and they're a key partner. So what we're doing, they'll be trying to implement at the installation as we go forward. So we're working without boundaries in the county, and we need to also look at our area. You know, Monroe County's leading this effort, but water travels through boundary municipal boundaries, it travels through watersheds, and everybody's affected. So that's the unique part. People are paying attention, people are participating, so which is great.
And when you say that the Green Fire Project, is this an advocacy group? How is it working in tandem with the Climate Change Task Force?
So the Wisconsin Green Fire is the expertise, or the
Okay.
retired a lot of DNR science world type people, the professionals that have collaborated, and we have a couple folks from the Wisconsin Green Fire that are leading the Monroe County Climate Readiness and Rural Economic Opportunity Assessment. They're coordinating this effort and bringing all this outside expertise. They're very good at networking and knowing who to specialize in certain areas related to the four sub-teams we have formed to address climate change.
Yeah, so they're kind of like your greater consultants as you go about this work.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to view it.
You know, Bob, climate change is happening. Your county believes that, but how fast can you move on adapting because you have all these objectives? Are your plans achievable in amount of time that you can avoid another crisis?
So our 10 objectives that we put together, there was 10 of them, and so the order is based on how quick we can implement or address that situation. And so the first and foremost was to alert and keep people out of harm's way, or the, out of the floodway. And we're doing that right now. Second, mitigate intense rain events on the landscape, manage the runoff. And the last one, which is the most difficult one, to change human behavior on the landscape to address the cause or climate change. And so the Green Fire Project is going to point all the arrows and offer opportunity and options to address climate change. We're doing everything we can to get to that point. And on the first three points that I talked about is, the warning systems, getting that out there, mitigate intense rain events on the landscape. And we can do that. We have the tools as conservationists to do that, along with managing runoff. At a certain point, though, some of these rain events, we can't design our way out of. They're too big of an event. So the best thing we can do is stay out of its way.
What have you learned by having so many different voices at the table and different priorities at the table?
I think the bottom line is for everybody that participates or questions or calls, that is interest and people acknowledging that there is a lot of change going on in the landscape. And so how do you harness that energy and make change? And that's the largest challenge because, like you said, there's a lot of different viewpoints coming to the table. So shaping that to make positive change is probably the hardest task that we're dealing with. But we're bringing in as many expertise or experts that we can help guide us and lead us through this change and start creating change for the positive.
Keith is with us from Toma. Hi, Keith, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I have my comment is that I feel that the emphasis is put on the lakes and the streams, whereas I believe the emphasis should be put on the actual watershed. Each watershed should be evaluated, and there's farming practices in Monroe County that's mostly soybean and corn, which does very little to retain water, maybe an inch of water, rainwater an hour. Whereas if you planted a root crop, you could advance that to maybe 20 inches an hour. Mm-hmm. So I think the problem is the source. The source is the farmer.
Keith, thank you. Bob, short on time, your thoughts?
Yep. So Keith brings up a good point. In agriculture, there's been a huge shift. And that shift is the loss of the dairy industry over the last 5 to 10 years. So with that, that hay that's that perennial crop in the rotation is now corn and beans. And then you pair that with the climate change symptoms of intense and heavy rains has increased the amount of erosion, severity of these storm events, and that runoff he was alluding to. So very good point, Keith.
Bob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and always willing to talk about Monroe County's efforts.
Bob McKeel, Director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department. Coming up, we talk with a UW-Madison economics professor who is proposing that the state outsource the work of the unemployment benefits system in some part in an effort to solve the problems plaguing how claims are processed. We'll talk about it after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're exploring what to do about Wisconsin's unemployment claim system that was in a backlog crisis last year. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A new report suggests that the Department of Workforce Development, DWD, should outsource at least a portion of the system. DWD Secretary Amy Pahacek told us in February that she's working with a 50-year-old mainframe with a lot of manual processes.
One of the things I was most shocked when I first got to DWD back in September was to hear that if a claimant needed to get us some type of proof of either wages or identity, they had to either mail or fax documentation into the department. That's how antiquated our systems are.
Should Wisconsin prioritize in modernizing its system or outsource unemployment claims processing? A mix of both, perhaps. 800-642-1234. Noah Williams is a macroeconomics professor at UW-Madison, director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy, which produced this report. Noah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Glad to join you.
Well, you specialize in looking at economies as a whole, at the macro level and the performance of the economy as a whole. When you look at Wisconsin's unemployment system compared to the rest of the nation, what do you see?
We see a system that really struggled throughout the course of the year, fell behind drastically in the early phase of the pandemic with the big spike in unemployment claims, never really caught up. And as has continued to suffer severe deterioration of performance, lower payment rates, more delays, and along a number of dimensions, Wisconsin has actually been among one of the worst performing states in the country.
Well, elaborate there a little bit on how you see Wisconsin stacking up on these, you know, particular variables compared to other states.
Sure. One of the things I looked at in the report was just there's a lot of news stories and coverage about the filing of unemployment claims. Like every week, there's a release on how many initial claims are filed, and people take that as a proxy for layoffs. But it turns out only a small portion of the people who file claims actually end up getting benefits. Since March of 2020, Wisconsin, only about 30% of those initial claims have actually led to benefit payments. So 3 in 10 workers who file unemployment for unemployment end up getting paid. And out of the 48 states in the country whose data I found accurate, there are a couple outliers, which I didn't trust. Wisconsin was the fifth lowest rate of the states. So a lot of people who are filing, some of them are, you know, truly not eligible. There's actually been a growth in the ineligible population filing. Some of them are turned down. A lot of them just end up in the system with determinations which put a hold. They end up in reviews and seem to fall through the cracks. So along that dimension in particular, Wisconsin's been one of the worst. Another thing I looked at, was the delays in payments. So after people do file, we can then track how long does it take them to receive their first unemployment payment. And what we found was during last summer, over half, roughly about half of all initial unemployment claims, when they actually did get paid, took 10 weeks or more. Over the whole course of the pandemic, that rate has also been about 30%, which is the eighth highest rate among states. So a lot of people aren't getting paid. Those people who do end up getting benefits often have to wait months to receive their first payments.
Okay, so, 3 in 10 there, the statistic of the claims not being paid out, and then waiting for months, quite a bit of delay for people whose claims are approved. What have you seen, and I don't know if you looked at this, but as the pandemic has waned and the systems have been improved, people getting back to work, fewer claims being processed, has the unemployment system changed or looked better?
It improved somewhat, particularly at the end of the year. A number of payments, particularly here in Wisconsin, went out at the end of 2020. But payment rates have actually fallen even more this year. Again, some of that may be due to a shift in the number of people or the pool of people applying. But payment rates have been low and they've remained low. I said 30% over the past year. In recent months, it's been more like 12%. So it's fallen by another half. The rate of delays has gone down. It was really severe last summer into the fall, but it's still nearly twice the national average. So we're still seeing roughly 20% of people who do get unemployment payments are waiting 10 weeks or more. So it's gotten better, but it's still not performing, even up to national averages.
We're talking with Noah Williams, who's a macroeconomics professor at UW Madison, wrote a report on the problems of the State Department of Workforce Development and potential fixes to processing unemployment benefit claims. Your insights, your experiences as well at 800-642-1234. Noah, take us to the piece about outsourcing. With all these problems, how would you go about solving them?
So it's, as has been clear and as was mentioned in the lead-in, I mean, one of the issues has been the state information systems, the computer technology, which is decades old. But in addition to that, there have been problems just with assigning staff, with responding once all of the information was available. That was a particular problem which was noted in an audit last summer. My suggestion, I mean, again, we could, potentially work upon on multiple fronts. But my suggestion was, given the problems and given the continued problems, that perhaps the state should outsource at least a portion of the processing, particularly obviously things which could be more automated, could be farmed out to a private contractor. The state did bring in Google at the end of last year to help with some of the backlog of claims, and that sort of coincides with the period that I mentioned at the end of the year where there was an increase in payments. But that was a temporary alliance, and the state of the system has really reverted to what I think is or what seems to have been more normal. So either a longer-term contracting or actually moving some of the functions to a private business may expedite the processing of claims.
What portion of the claims process do you see would be prone to outsourcing or be a good candidate for outsourcing?
So there are some functions which the Department of Labor actually requires to be, which are truly governmental functions, which is making the actual decisions on when do people get benefits or not. But the whole front end, how people apply for claims, the taking of claims and dealing with questions on the phone, which again was a big problem, particularly last summer. Majority of calls weren't being answered. So taking of claims, processing of data, all of that could be outsourced to an automated data processing company.
So, you know, outsourcing potentially could save on wages, potentially could improve efficiency in getting these claims processed. But isn't that a gamble? You put a third party in the driver's seat, and that is a risk. Your HR may now be housed in another country because the state is going with the lowest bidder on the contract. There are security risks. There are quality risks. How do you weigh that in your cost benefit?
So, certainly we would want to monitor that situation and include those safeguards. I mean, of course, privacy is a paramount issue, particularly dealing with payroll data. And there's a lot of personal information which is involved here. So so we certainly would want a strong oversight and review. But I still think, again, given that this has gone on for more than a year now, the gains could outweigh those additional costs.
In what way? Where do you see the most gains here by outsourcing a piece of the claims process?
So it would be just speeding the, essentially making the whole process easier, right? So, I think it helps to step back for just a sec to think about, what is the role of unemployment insurance, right? It's to provide liquidity, to provide income for people who are thrown out of work. We've seen a whole lot of people fall through the cracks, or even if they did get benefits, end up waiting months and months. So if we could both make the process easier to navigate, quicker to come to a decision, and then one thing which I haven't touched on, but which is in the report, more accurate as well at making payments. What I found was, a quarter of the payments that do go out from the state have been overpayments, so they've had to try to recoup some of that. There's also been, increasing reports of unemployment fraud around the country, but ex-ante fraud detection has gone down. The number of absolute cases of fraud in the state that have been detected has fallen by about 40%, even as claims more than, have skyrocketed. So improving along all those dimensions, making it easier for people to navigate, making it quicker to turn around to get the benefits, and for taxpayers and for the state, providing a more accurate payment system. I think all of those are dimensions which we could improve on.
Let's bring in perspective from Mark in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, back in 2010-11, I believe, unemployment, the way to apply and get unemployment was dramatically changed. And it was purposely made more difficult on purpose. And so now we're seeing the result, and then people are complaining about it. We have decades-old computers. They were purposely not updated. So the idea was that it should be hard to get your unemployment claim filled because basically it seems to me the attitude towards unemployment, the unemployed, was that they were just people who didn't want to work, which is patently false. And so this complaint, the idea of outsourcing to fix a problem, that this was a problem that was actually made on purpose. The goal, the design of unemployment, well before the pandemic, was to make it difficult to collect unemployment.
Noah, your thoughts?
I guess I don't know that there was a purpose. I wouldn't assign a purposeful motive for making unemployment insurance more difficult. It's clear that there were job search requirements and other
waiting periods.
Uh-huh. Waiting period. Those have been waived during the pandemic, and we haven't seen much change or improvement there. So I guess I'm not sure of the call. I don't want to assign motive here.
We're talking with UW-Madison economics professor Noah Williams, who's explaining his research on Wisconsin's unemployment system, how it stacks up across the nation. DWD has said the system would cost $90 million to upgrade, years to complete. Should Wisconsin make the investment to modernize? What could be permanently outsourced? Join in your perspective, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about a new 17-page report from the UW-Madison Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy that investigated how the state struggled to process unemployment claims in the pandemic and whether an outsourced HR company could be part of a solution. Economics professor Noah Williams authored the study and said, and he's with us for about 10 more minutes. We heard from Annette in Green Bay, called in, couldn't stay with us. Annette says her husband was unemployed at one point. He applied for unemployment, and by the next week, he had his money. She says it seems like the system was working well in and around before the Walker administration. Noah, the Department of Workforce Development is critical of your report, saying that the data you used isn't apples to apples, saying that it's unfair to compare pandemic statistics to figures during normal years. And that, you know, for context, here's DWD Secretary Amy Pahacik talking with us in February.
Since March of 2020 through last month, there were over 10 million unemployment claims filed. In the 4 years prior, from 2016 to 2019, there were a total of 7.2 million claims. So the department had over 4.5 years worth of work in 10 months.
Over 4.5 years of work in 10 months. What is your response to your data inputs here?
Well, my comparison was really about Wisconsin in comparison to other states. So, our system, other states around the country, and in fact, the whole nation, faced a similar increase in unemployment claims. So I think what this crush of volume of unemployment claims did was expose the weaknesses in particular state systems. And what we saw was our system was among the worst. So it's true. Yeah, this is clearly an unprecedented time. We haven't seen anything like this. So the level of unemployment, the rapid increase in unemployment claims. But I think, just that type of stress test is useful to see where the problems in the systems lie.
And when you look around the country, according to Pew Research, Wisconsin is not alone. States have been really hobbled by COBOL that was intended for processing a small number of claims, like New York, New Jersey, Maine have all struggled with these same issues. Did you find in your research what other states are doing for solutions with their COBOL systems?
So some states have moved to modernize. Some made the transition earlier, of course, and weren't subject to this. New York was also a state who contracted out to Google for a longer period of time and to help them process their backlog and to get payments made more rapidly. So yeah, so it's true. We're not alone in this, but even given that, we haven't done as well as other states have.
Would you think it is cheaper and faster to outsource the functions of a particular piece of state government to private industry?
Excuse me, cheaper and faster, or as opposed to?
As opposed to keeping this in-house.
There is a question, perhaps it's a kind of a long-term budgeting issue, but whether it makes sense to invest resources to upgrade our system in-house as opposed to taking advantage of private industry, which already has these capacities. So certainly in the short term, it would make sense to outsource, or likely make sense to outsource looking at along those lines.
And when you look at the current partnerships with Google Cloud to assist on claim determinations, you saw an uptick in productivity in getting these claims processed. What do you see happening there?
At the end of the year, there were there was a big spike in payments as Google came in, and a lot of the old claims, the backlog, was taken care of. But again, claims are still piling up, and the payment rate has gone back down. Delays, have come down from where they were, but they've remained higher. So it's been an improvement, but it hasn't, hasn't again even brought us down to national averages.
We're talking with Noah Williams, who is founding director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy at UW-Madison. He wrote a report on the problems that the state is facing in processing unemployment claims and suggesting a piece of this work could be outsourced to a private company. Do you think that is the best road, or are you concerned about outsourcing this work could lead to new problems? 800-642-1234. Nancy is joining us from Madison. Hi, Nancy. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are very strongly opposed to any outsourcing. I'm really very tired of the idea of outsourcing. I do not want my tax dollars to be transferred to private companies, and certainly not to private companies overseas or anywhere. I want our system updated, and I want it done within the state and within the state of Wisconsin employment area. I am opposed to what this gentleman is propounding. I'm totally against it, and it should not happen. Thank you.
Nancy, thanks. Noah, keeping her tax dollars local in Wisconsin, very opposed on this idea of outsourcing.
I don't know. She didn't really provide an argument, so I don't know what to say to that other than she was opposed.
She's saying, look, I don't want to use my tax dollars and send them to private companies that are either, you know, out of state, maybe, you know, providing people with a lower wage than they could make in Wisconsin, or perhaps, you know, companies in another country doing this processing. I mean, that was one of the points she made.
Okay. Well, so there are certainly in-state providers. If that is an issue, there certainly are in-state providers that that could be contracted with. There's, you know, a number of data processing payroll companies have locations in the state if that is an issue. You know, if it comes down to investing in hardware, which is produced overseas at lower wages, as opposed to providing ongoing resources, it's not clear that there's a strong trade-off of one versus the other.
Okay. So, you know, hardware could be a concern because it would be produced outside of Wisconsin. But in terms of the people and the people employed, you know, would you see that to be a benefit to have that inside Wisconsin, those people resources?
I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other on that. I mean, I think ultimately what we want is we want to provide more efficient, cost-effective government services, whether that's done by employing people directly here in Madison, largely, or elsewhere. If at the end of the day, the benefit, the service improvement increases, I think that's ultimately what we should care about.
Noah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Noah Williams is a macroeconomics professor, founding director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy at UW-Madison. Just ahead, we learn the backstory behind Wisconsin's first and only Black-owned brewery in Oshkosh. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.